Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the first of the three lectures Professor Roger Lewis is going to be delivering on the subject of Ant and Eden series. Not perhaps the traumatic experience for the younger members of this audience as it was for my generation. Series divided the nation in my generation, I suppose, as much as Munich did my father's. There were those who thought it was immoral. There were those who thought that it was wrong to say anything was immoral if it was done by Her Majesty's government. And there were those smaller group like myself who felt like the immortal words of Oscar Wilde, that it was worse than a crime, it was a blunder. Since then we've had progressively evidence released, and for the last few years, a couple of years or so, Ant and Eden's own papers have been available. Professor Lewis is, I could say without any hope of being contradicted or any danger of being contradicted, the most distinguished historian of England, particularly of British Empire and of the processes by which it gradually eased itself off the world stage, known to either side of the Atlantic. Since 1986, he's been the Carr Professor of English History and Culture at the University of Texas at Austin. I say Carr because it's a good Scottish name. I'm sure that if I have it rightly, it's the Kerr Chair in Austin. He's been a visiting fellow to All Souls. He's a permanent overseas fellow of Churchill College. He has very much the same kind of relationship with St. Anthony's. He did his DPhil at Oxford. He is almost as familiar with this side of the Atlantic as he is on the other side, though I see to my regret that he's not yet found his way into the English Who's Who, where he belongs just as readily as it seems to me as the American version of it. His two best-known books are Imperialism at Bay, a study of the debate between Britain and America over the British Empire during the Second World War, and his later volume, The British Empire in the Middle East. But these are only, as we are now going through the research evaluation exercise, and are only allowed to mention two works. I'm confining myself to his two best-known works. He's held Marshall Fellowships, Guggenheim Fellowships, Woodrow Wilson Fellowships, and he was, in 1990, the Cicely Lecturer in Oxford. The lectures which he's given are to be published in a revised form by Cambridge University Press. And we're very personally regarded as a great success, and we are all honored to have him here amongst us. So.
Thank you, Professor Watt, and ladies and gentlemen. The subject of Suez continues to fascinate because the issues, which are ethical as well as political, resound to the present day. Intervention requires consistency and nerve. Restraint requires as much courage and determination as intervention. Throughout most of his career, Sir Anthony Eden pursued a policy of conciliation towards Egypt until he finally resorted to a military course of action to topple Gamal Abdel Nasser. He was not merely the head of the Egyptian government, but the personification of Arab nationalism. Eden, too, had a mystique about him. He had inherited the mantle of Winston Churchill, and Churchill himself had played a critical part in establishing Eden's reputation as the one strong figure who, in standing up to the dictators in the 1930s, embodied the life hope of the British nation. In the 1950s, Eden represented the hope of holding fast in the Middle East. In attempting to preserve Britain's imperial greatness, he faced the moral dilemma of intervention. He had to choose, in his own view, between two extreme alternatives of lasting significance. For Eden himself, the decision to intervene marked the turning point in his policy, his career, and his life. The consequences were disastrous. The reason lies in the ambiguity of method as well as in the decision himself. When he concluded the secret agreement with France and Israel, And when he later denied accusation of collusion in the House of Commons, he consciously deceived not only his own officials, but also the British people. It might be argued that at least at one level, he deceived even himself, but I do not believe that this was the case. Eden knew what he was doing. This was part of his problem when he stepped over the boundary of doing what he himself believed to be dishonorable. In the first of these three lectures, I shall place the phases of Eden's life and career in the context of Suez by inquiring into the formative influences that helped to explain his stand in 1956. In searching for an understanding of Suez, it is useful to inquire into Eden's service under Austen Chamberlain, Stanley Baldwin, Neville Chamberlain, and, of course, Churchill. There are continuities and recurring themes from the 1920s to the 1950s. One of the continuities is the derivative nature of Eden's ideas. He was not an original thinker, but absorbed the thoughts of others, pondering them until they became his own. One source of inspiration was the cluster of permanent officials, as well as his heroes, such as Austen Chamberlain and Baldwin. The significance is that at the time of the Suez Crisis, Eden was a representative figure, but he was not an original one, and he did not command overall respect as a natural leader. My first lecture will carry the story to Eden's decision in the spring of 1956 to destroy Nasser. The second lecture will deal with the actual crisis to the time of Eden's decision to collude with the French and the Israelis in October 1956. The third lecture will consider the British attack and the decision in favor of a ceasefire. I am grateful to Dr. John Barnes for allowing me to read an unpublished paper by him on cabinet decisions during the crisis. I also acknowledge from the outset my debt to the biographies by David Carlton and Robert Rhodes James, as well as the work on Suez by Keith Kyle, which is the one indispensable book on the subject. And most recently, I have read the biography by Victor Rothwell, which has just been published. On any lecture on Suez, one wishes to know immediately what is new. The lectures are based, as far as I have been able, on a review of the unpublished documentation at the Public Record Office and on the various collections of private papers, including, of course, those of Eden himself. On the main theme of interpretation, I wish to clarify Eden's views about the League of Nations as well as the United Nations and on the crucial part played from the late 1930s by Lord Cranborne, later Lord Salisbury. And the central questions are, what were the antecedents of Eden's course of action, which is the central question for this lecture? How did Eden manage to hold the members of the cabinet together during the crisis, and why did he or they decide to end the military operation so abruptly? Well, the formative experience in Eden's life was the First World War. He fought at Passchendaele in the Somme. In 1917, he was awarded the Military Cross for rescuing his sergeant under fire. In 1918, at the age of 20, he was the youngest brigade major in the British Army. He emerged from the war as a man of undoubted courage, but he was not renowned for a knowledge of military tactics or strategy. There is a hint here for an understanding of the Suez Crisis, or at least of Eden's interventions in military planning. Despite combat experience, he never devoted himself to a systematic or probing analysis of the principles of warfare that would have distinguished him as possessing an exceptional military mind. He became an expert on disarmament and overseas defense policy, and he spoke with authority on the subject of bomber and aerial warfare. But by no stretch of the imagination was he an innovative thinker. Especially in military affairs, he was a Churchill manqué. In 1956, it came as a shock to Eden that at least 6 weeks would be required to mount an assault on Egypt. Now, to say that Eden lacked Churchill's aggressive originality is not to say that he would not have been a competent general officer. On the strength of natural ability and with a little luck through contacts, he would probably have risen to the top of almost any profession, military, financial, legal, even academic. William Rees-Mogg observed in a biography written before the Suez Crisis that Eden would have, in the academic world, he would have been a head of house, not a professor, the director of the LSE, not the Stevenson Professor of International History. The point is significant because in the postmortems on 1956, there is a tendency to regard Eden as a lightweight or a mediocrity. This is not an accurate impression. Once he made up his mind, he could hold his own in the give and take of discussion and in the heat of argument, even with Churchill. At the close of the First World War, Eden hesitated in his choice of career. Election to Parliament emerged as his ultimate aim. He was eventually elected in 1923 at the age of 26. At the end of the war, he had, however, decided to pursue his education. At Oxford, 1919 to 22, he studied Persian and Arabic. He acquired an aesthetic appreciation of the languages and spoke of their mystic richness. By dint of hard work and by application of his natural talent, he obtained a first-class degree. Though there were few candidates in the subject, and the significance of his success is not as great as it might seem. I am indebted to Albert Hirani for inquiring into this matter. In the 1920-29 period, there were only a few students in Persian and Arabic. In other words, Eden, and by my calculation, only one other, by Albert Hirani's calculation, possibly two or three others. One of Eden's teachers and examiners was Reuben Levy, a good linguist but not an eminent scholar. He was once asked about Eden, and the response was, not an impressive student. Churchill later reacted with astonishment rather than reverence. When he learned of Eden's academic achievement, he detected something incongruous. Eden did, however, work much more industriously than one might have guessed from his clipped, languid accent of Eden in Christchurch. He joined the Asiatic Society at Oxford. He became its president. He presided over discussions on the imperial duty to defend the Suez Canal and on the destiny of the British Empire, the natural frontiers of which would rest on the Himalayas. If there was a lingering lesson learned from his Oxford days relevant to the Suez Crisis, it concerned the great game of Asia, which had entered its denouement in the Middle East. The lesson was that with confidence, skill, and persistence, the British would prevail. Some were already pessimistic, but Eden appears never to have doubted Britain's imperial place in the world. Eden seldom elaborated on the principles of his thought on the Middle East, and when he did, the results were often banal. There was, however, an underlying continuity. Martin White, a perceptive academic critic, identified it when he observed that in Eden's mental universe, the relations between Britain and the states of the Middle East were slightly different from those that prevailed in the rest of the international community. This is a vital distinction. Arab nationalism, in Eden's mind, could never be reconciled with British dominance. There could be no harmony of interests, merely the perpetuation of an unequal system. If persuasion failed, then other means were necessary. The Oriental mind ultimately respects and understands only force. Such were Eden's presuppositions. Britain would pursue a policy of conciliation, but the implicit corollary was that the puppet regimes must be accommodating. The velvet glove of conciliation necessarily conceals the fist of coercion. These assumptions, Eden's assumptions, were not uncommon. In the pre-revolutionary Middle East, before the 1950s, most British Arabists would have subscribed to them. Formative experiences are often the most revealing. Eden's apprenticeship in foreign affairs began in 1926 as parliamentary private secretary to Sir Austen Chamberlain, the foreign secretary. Chamberlain had held high office before 1914. Eden, who was beginning his political career in the 1920s, acquired from him a working knowledge of the principles of British foreign policy before the First World War. Austen Chamberlain held as an axiom that Britain's aim was not merely to prevent the dominance of Europe by a single European power, but also to maintain Britain's trade and commerce, spheres of influence, protectorates, mandates, and colonies throughout the world. Though Britain would uphold the principles of the League of Nations, anti-colonial sentiment would be resisted. For the Americans, Chamberlain had a streak of contempt, which Eden shared despite later protests to the contrary. Chamberlain, indeed, believed that Britain might act on her own in almost all parts of the world except the Far East, a point that has a bearing on Suez. To use the pre-First World War language that Chamberlain preferred, because of its clarity, the Middle East was predominantly a British sphere of influence. It is useful to remember that in foreign affairs, Eden was the disciple of Sir Austen Chamberlain. Chamberlain was the first foreign secretary to take part in the debates of the League. Eden traveled with him to Geneva and participated in conversations with Aristide Briand and Gustave Stresemann. He learned that the League was useful for contacts, but he perceived the League's limitations. Later, he became identified with the principle of collective security, but it is important to note that this was a qualified commitment that flowed from British self-interest rather than from an international abstraction or an ideal. Following Chamberlain's example, Eden from the beginning thought that agreements on security and settlements of disputes should be accomplished through direct negotiations and not through the League. The League could serve as an instrument to further British purposes, but only if the British kept their obligations limited and the functions of the League circumscribed. Eden's outlook was therefore different in kind from that of Lord Robert Cecil, who believed that the League should be given the authority to resolve international conflicts and that the concept of collective security therefore should be broadened. There was no similar commitment on Eden's part. From his early experience under Chamberlain down to the time of the Suez Crisis, Eden was skeptical about the capacity of international organization, whether the League or the United Nations, to resolve conflict. The key to Eden in the 1930s is that he was very much a man of the times. He caught the public eye in newspaper photographs and in the early news films as a dashing figure, almost a dandy, especially in comparison with his older colleagues. He was unmistakably a younger aristocrat abreast the currents of the modern age. The Noel Coward of international politics, as a popular line had it, dressed with sartorial splendor in bold striped suits with a gold watch fob and a ubiquitous white handkerchief tucked jauntily in the top pocket of the jacket. He wore the hat, forever associated with him, the black Homburg. The mustache curled inward. How much substance was there behind the glamorous public image? Robert Rhodes James has written that Eden was generally perceived as the one man who actually made the League work. How then did this reputation emerge? What, to rephrase another question, was the substance and the reality of Eden as a League of Nations man? Eden's mentor was the once and future Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin, who step by step advanced Eden's career by securing him positions as Parliamentary Undersecretary at the Foreign Office in 1931 to Minister for League of Nations Affairs in 1935. Eden did have a sensitive and adaptable personality, though he later complained that Baldwin did not support him sufficiently. The patron provided the inspiration. Eden's ideas about the League came to resemble Baldwin's. Baldwin himself possessed more positive notions about the League than might be assumed from his own reputation as a lackadaisical Tory who would prefer to unbutton his trousers in public than to speak a foreign language. Like others of his generation, Baldwin held as a central tenet that the First World War had been caused in large part by the armaments race. He was committed in principle to a policy of disarmament, but not unilateral disarmament. Disarmament was one of the two pillars of his foreign policy. The League of Nations was the other. The League was a forum in which to pursue international conciliation. It would be imperfect as long as the United States and the Soviet Union were not members, but eventually the League might become an effective instrument for the prevention of war, as well as an arm of the British foreign policy. Those ideas became Eden's ideas. By appointing Eden as Minister for League of Nations Affairs, Baldwin hoped to check the legomaniacs, notably Lord Robert Cecil. Eden was a man of the times in the specific sense that he struck a resounding popular chord by serving in causes that many thought mistakenly to be pacifist. At the disarmament conference at Geneva, 1932-34, Eden bore the brunt of the work. This was a critical episode in his career that gave him a working knowledge and considerable expertise on problems of bombers and reconnaissance aircraft, tanks and heavy artillery, capital ships and submarines. Publicly, he advocated a radical and total abolition of military and naval aircraft. In fact, compelling reasons of British security underlay this approach. "We were so weak in air power," he wrote, "that any national air limitations were bound to be to our advantage." His colleagues acknowledged his expertise as well as the respect that he won at Geneva. Eden followed the lead of the Foreign Secretary, Sir John Simon, but Eden himself managed to inspire some of his colleagues as well as certain sections of the public in a way that the bland and equivocal Simon certainly could not. Eden seemed to stand in spirited contrast to Simon and the older generation of politicians. In the end, the disarmament conference resulted in failure, but Eden acquired from it a reputation as a tough-minded yet debonair young diplomat who could master complex technical detail and persuasively argue his case. In the International Society of Geneva, Eden found his element. How did he get on with his colleagues, and what were the disagreements? The issue of the 1930s relevant to Suez is the Ethiopian crisis. During the Suez crisis and after, Eden reflected whether Nasser most resembled Hitler or Mussolini. He believed that the example of Mussolini provided the closer analogy. Eden increasingly distrusted and opposed Hitler, but he wished to settle with Hitler at Mussolini's expense. Mussolini was, even more than Hitler in Eden's opinion, a complete gangster. Eden meant more than banditry and bluster. Mussolini represented an immediate danger to Britain's position in the Eastern Mediterranean, which in Eden's global perspective was the key to British survival. During the Ethiopian crisis, Eden was only by degrees removed from Sir Samuel Hoare, the Foreign Secretary, and Sir Robert Van Sittart, the permanent Undersecretary at the Foreign Office, who carried Eden with them, by and large, in the plan to yield to Mussolini's demands. R.A.C. Parker, the historian who has examined in detail Eden's part in the Ethiopian crisis, catches the faltering quality of Eden's intellect with words that hold true for Suez as well as Ethiopia. The cabinet and foreign office records show that any divergences between him himself on the one side and Hoare and Van Sittart on the other were expressed with far less clarity and force than outside opinion supposed. Then, as at other times, Eden gives the impression of hesitancy in argument, perhaps the result of indecision in thought. As at Suez, the key to Eden's position in 1935 was his assessment of France. He did not wish to become committed to sanctions or to become involved in a war with Italy without guarantees of French military support. Without France, sanctions against Italy would be ineffective and the British fleet in the Mediterranean would be put at risk. He thus supported the plan put forward by Van Sittart and carried by Hoare to Paris, where it was embraced by Pierre Laval, the French foreign minister. When news of it leaked in the press, it caused a sensation in England. Hoare was forced to resign, but Eden had been in Geneva and was not directly involved in the negotiations. To those on the inside, he was implicated up to his neck, yet Eden emerged from the Ethiopian crisis unscathed. He escaped public criticism, Baldwin viewed him as an asset precisely because of the League of Nations connection. In December 1935, Baldwin appointed Eden as Hoare's replacement. At the age of 38, Eden thus became one of the youngest foreign secretaries in British history. The meteor had soared to a spectacular height in an era of spectacular events. Mussolini's triumph in Ethiopia, Hitler's reoccupation of the Rhineland, the onset of the Spanish Civil War, the ongoing conflict in the Far East. In this galaxy of crises, the point of interest for Suez is the conclusion in August 1936 of the Anglo-Egyptian treaty, which for Eden was a stroke of luck during his first year. It signified a major adjustment in Anglo-Egyptian relations. Against the background of Italian conquest in Ethiopia, the British and the Egyptians found cause to embrace. The discussions had long been underway before Eden became Foreign Secretary, but he helped to bring them to a conclusion, chiefly by following the advice of the Egyptian Department in the Foreign Office, and especially the lead of the High Commissioner in Egypt, Sir Miles Lampson. The British base established by the Treaty of 1936 extended from the Mediterranean to the Red Sea and westward three-quarters of the way to Cairo. The British acquired unqualified privileges for garrisons, airfields, naval flying boat stations, training areas, rail and road networks, as well as the security of transit through the canal. This was the Suez base. Much later, reflecting on the dramatic events of the year 1936, Eden wrote that this treaty was one of the very few worthwhile settlements negotiated in that time of international lawlessness. Part of the calculation was that the treaty would help to appease the nationalist movement in Egypt and to demonstrate that the old order of British subjugation had at last ended. The Egyptian prime minister was Nahas Pasha, who, in the words of a British official in Cairo, at that time possessed the mystical personal appeal of the traditional Oriental national hero. Nahas commanded the support of the WAFT, the National Party, yet in the eyes of many Egyptian nationalists, including Nasser, Nahas represented also the corrupt landed classes. By virtue of his association with Nahas, Eden became linked to the old regime. He was publicly associated as well with Sir Miles Lampson, who in every sense was the architect of the treaty. It is important to establish the identity of outlook of Eden and Lampson in 1936. Eden was equivocal about the future of Egypt, at times musing that the best course might be to incorporate Egypt directly into the British imperial system rather than maintain the fiction of Egypt as an independent state. Both Eden and Lampson continued to regard Egypt, though independent, as part of the British Empire. Lampson, indeed, personified the imperial presence. One observer later recalled the irony of Eden's achievement of the treaty by reflecting that Lampson, to all appearances, carried on exactly as before. There he was, behaving in much the same way as before the treaty, with his special train and all, flying his flag in the same conspicuous residence associated in every Egyptian mind with British rule since Cromer. In the mid-1930s, Eden and Neville Chamberlain were not basically in disagreement. In June 1936, Chamberlain, while still Chancellor of the Exchequer, had denounced sanctions against Italy as the very midsummer of madness. Eden was also moving in the direction of abandoning sanctions. On the future of the League of Nations also, Eden was not much of a champion. In the same year, he told Chamberlain that the League ought to be transformed into a forum or a moral force without the power of sanctions. For peace, Eden wrote, we should depend upon a system of regional pacts to be registered and approved by the League. Nor were Eden and Chamberlain irreconcilable on how to deal with the dictator powers. Neither believed that much could be done about Japan. Eden was much more distrustful of Italy than Chamberlain, and Eden's judgment on Germany eventually proved to be more accurate. But Eden, too, believed in appeasement. The two men clashed as much in temperament and in the method of conducting business as in the substance of policy. Chamberlain effectively arrogated the powers to make decisions in foreign affairs without consulting the Foreign Office, which Eden naturally resented. were eaten in a highly wrought frame of mind in November 1937, protested against Chamberlain going over his head and approaching Hitler, the Prime Minister, in a famous phrase, told him to go back to bed and to take an aspirin. Eden was suffering from influenza at the time, but, and here is the point, those concerned with Eden's health in 1956 would have recognized some of the same symptoms and prickly behavior 20 years earlier. Now, it is ironic that Eden in 1956 made some of the same mistakes as had Chamberlain, who was so convinced of the power of his own logic and the justice of his cause that he brooked no interference. Eden's intellectual arrogance, substantial though it became, never approached Neville Chamberlain's, but Eden did eventually use some of the same methods. Chamberlain, who harbored an inveterate suspicion of the Foreign Office, preferred to work through an inner rung in the cabinet and through personal advisors. Eden, in 1956, never relied on advice from the equivalents of Sir Warren Fisher and Sir Horace Wilson, but he did work through cabinet committees to circumvent or cut off the influence of the Foreign Office and thus isolated himself from expert advice on Egypt. It is ironic also that when Eden's break with Chamberlain occurred in February 1938, it came about in part over the issue of Anglo-American relations, which was precisely the cause of Eden's downfall at Suez. Chamberlain not only despised the United States, but believed Roosevelt to be incapable of firm action. Eden, though he disliked individual Americans and thought that the State Department to be quixotic and even fickle, consistently believed until Suez that in world politics and above all in the Far East, the British and the Americans should collaborate. In January 1938, Chamberlain, without consulting Eden, rejected a proposal by Roosevelt to convene a conference on European affairs. In February, again without consulting Eden, Chamberlain proposed to recognize Italy's annexation of Ethiopia. Eden was not so much opposed to the policy as he was to the double dealing behind his back. 20 February 1938, Eden resigned as Foreign Secretary. The resignation was one of the great public events in the late 1930s. People cheered wherever Eden went. In the act of defiance against Chamberlain, Eden seemed to stand as the champion of the League of Nations and the democracies, as well as a lone voice against the dictators. A.J.P. Taylor has written that Eden, the man of strong words, acquired retrospectively a mythical reputation as the man who had favored strong acts and became a symbol of resistance to Chamberlain's policy. There is truth in this view, but it would be wrong to underestimate the strength of public sentiment and the intense loyalty of Eden's supporters at the time. In John Wheeler's Bennett's words, written long afterwards and despite the experience of Suez, Eden represented a courageous struggle for sanity in international diplomacy. Eden appeared to emerge in heroic contrast to an older generation of discredited politicians. The younger men sympathized in various degrees with Eden, but they all assumed in the end that the will of the Prime Minister should prevail. There were similar lines of division between older and younger men in the cabinet in 1956, and much speculation, as in Chamberlain's case, about the Prime Minister accepting advice from an inner ring of ministers and ignoring the requests of others. In 1938, besides Eden himself, the only resignations were Lord Cranbourne, his parliamentary undersecretary, and J.P.L. Thomas, his parliamentary private secretary. In 1956, the resignations were also few, but also significant. Eden, above all, had the unswerving support of Lord Cranbourne, who later, as Lord Salisbury, played a principal part in the Suez Crisis and remained Eden's close friend despite Suez. Eden evoked Cranbourne's personal loyalty as he did that of others. Indeed, Eden's friends and admirers saw in him a greater firmness of purpose and nobility of mind than he would ever have claimed himself. It was Churchill who played the critical part in creating the legend of Eden as the hero of the age. Dire times require heroic figures. Churchill stated in the House of Commons with words that caught the public spirit at the time of Eden's resignation in 1938, "All over the world, in every land, under every sky and system of government, wherever they may be, the friends of England are dismayed, and the foes of England are exultant." Churchill was Eden's dark angel. No sooner had Churchill promoted Eden to the War Office in 1940 than Churchill told him that he would be his successor. Churchill in 1941 wrote to the king that if anything were to happen to him, Eden should succeed him. But this continued for 15 years. Eden was appointed Foreign Secretary for the second time in December 1940, and he remained in the post until the Labor victory of 1945. I'll not say much about Eden and Churchill because I believe that this is a topic that everyone here knows about, and I should add that my real motive is that I have other things that I would rather discuss, and I am clearly pressed for time. There are, however, a few points that I think are worth bearing in mind, and one is the judgment by Sir Alexander Cadogan, the permanent undersecretary at the Foreign Office during the wartime period, that Eden, as Foreign Secretary, was hardworking, conscientious, and able. Cadogan was a shrewd judge of character. He believed that Eden checked Churchill's prejudices and was an honorable man. On the other hand, or at the other extreme, it is important not to forget the epithet used by Randolph Churchill and Evelyn Waugh that became popular during the war when Eden was referred to contemptuously as the jerk. Eden had his detractors as well as those who genuinely respected him. The last point worth bearing in mind, I believe, regards Churchill himself and his own moment of doubt in 1955 on the eve of Eden's becoming prime minister when he said, "I don't believe Antony can do it." Now, whether or not Eden could rise to the occasion, whether as prime minister or whether as the master of the Suez Crisis, was the perennial question. When Eden became Foreign Secretary again in late 1951, he rejected out of hand the possibility of a continued British occupation of the Canal Zone, in part for financial reasons. "We cannot afford to keep 80,000 men indefinitely in the Canal Zone," he wrote, and it was not merely a question of expense. He warned his colleagues in the cabinet about the discrepancy between the 80,000 troops in the Canal Zone and the 10,000 allowed by the 1936 treaty. "Let us not forget that we are in serious breach of the 1936 treaty," he wrote. "The presence of British troops might provoke a clash with the Egyptians, leading to full-scale military action and to the reoccupation of Egypt itself." Eden's analysis of the problem in 1952, 1953, as on other issues, makes ironic reading in light of the course of events in 1956. "Effective military operations against the Egyptians," he said, "would compel us to reoccupy Egypt with all the consequences with which this would entail. We should be likely to have world opinion against us and would find it difficult to make a case if Egypt took us to the United Nations." The 1954 base agreement represented the culmination of Eden's policy of reconciliation. He succeeded in extricating British troops from Suez. The last British troops left the Canal Zone in June 1956, 1 month before Nasser's takeover of the Canal Company. The British occupation of Egypt had ended. The removal of British forces might have been remembered as one of the glorious accomplishments of Eden's tenure as Foreign Secretary had it not been for Suez. The success in 1954 did make Eden vulnerable to charges of scuttle by those in the right wing of the Conservative Party. By withdrawing troops from Egypt and by helping to set the Sudan on the road to independence, he seemed to be caving in to the Egyptians. He damaged his reputation as an anti-appeaser in the House of Commons, Captain Charles Waterhouse and Julian Amory led a combination of Tory MPs known as the Suez Group. Waterhouse was a senior figure in the Conservative Party, and he had a romantic attachment to the Sudan, Kenya, and Uganda. Julian Amory defended the cause of the British Empire in the tradition of his father, Leo, who had served as colonial secretary in the 1920s and as Secretary of State for India during the Second World War. Leo Amory was the guru of the Suez Group. The younger members included Fitzroy Maclean, who had led the British mission to Tito during the war, and Enoch Powell, whose formidable powers of intellect and public speaking made him an asset to the cause. On one point, they all agreed. In Julian Amory's phrase, the Suez Canal represented the Clapham junction of the British Empire, and Eden's yielding of its control to the Egyptians represented a black page in the history of the British Empire. Now, Eden had been very much annoyed at the independent line taken by the American embassy in Cairo during the period of the base negotiations, and Eden especially blamed the ambassador, Jefferson Caffery, for leaking details of the British plan to the Egyptians and thus enabling the Egyptians to take a stronger stand. Eden naturally resented Caffery's assumption that the influence of the United States in the Middle East would continue to increase, along with that of the nationalists, and that Britain's power would diminish. Nevertheless, Eden was grateful to Caffery and to John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, for helping to bring about the agreement of 1954. It would be a mistake to believe that the British decided to evacuate the troops from the Canal Zone because of American pressure. As David Devereux, the author of a detailed book on British defense policy in the early 1950s, has written, it was a British achievement, pure and simple. It came about as a result of years of hard negotiation and perseverance against considerable domestic pressure. Eden and Salisbury deserve the most credit for this. During the period of the base negotiations, Eden had formed a negative impression of Foster Dulles. It is true, as David Carlton has pointed out, that Eden later exaggerated Dulles' personality and policies in an attempt to find a scapegoat for Suez, but Eden was perhaps more consistent in his dislike for Dulles than of any other contemporary, even Nasser. Dulles was ponderous, analytical, and not without considerable ingenuity, which Eden interpreted as cunning. Eden was quick, intuitive, and not without a certain impatience with legal reasoning, which Dulles thought to be indicative of a superficial mind. Eden's mannerism of saying, "My dear Foster," or merely "my dear," irritated Dulles as it did Eisenhower and other Americans. Eden misjudged the relationship between Dulles and Eisenhower. Eden was certainly not alone in making that mistake, but it was a critical error. Eisenhower was a strong president who knew his own mind. He respected Dulles, who in turn was a strong Secretary of State. Dulles had a capacious knowledge and pursued consistent policies, but he was careful to confer with Eisenhower on every important issue. Ultimately, it was Eisenhower who established the principles. He relied on Dulles' immense energy, learning, and ingenuity to implement them. Needless to say, nevertheless, Dulles in every sense was the executor of policy set by Eisenhower. Dulles' racy language and strong statements in press conferences gave the impression, especially to the British, that he, rather than the president, often took the lead. They made an effective team, in part because Dulles agreed with Eisenhower's judgment, but the nature of the partnership was concealed from the public. In the Suez Crisis, there were important differences on, for example, the future management of the canal and on the extent to which the United States should take the initiative. But Eisenhower's presidency was, in Fred Greenstein's phrase, one of the hidden hand. To the public, Eisenhower appeared to be a benign, slightly incoherent soldier president, somewhat out of his element. He cultivated that image. In reality, he was industrious, intelligent, and contemptuous of British power, Eden may be forgiven for not recognizing his true enemy. It was not Dulles, but Eisenhower. Dulles was not nearly so hostile. In Eden's own demonology, however, Dulles ranked along with Gamal Abdel Nasser as the chief villain. From Eden's retrospective vantage point, Nasser was a source of trouble from the time of the Egyptian Revolution in 1952, or at least from the time of his tract, published in 1954, entitled The Philosophy of the Revolution. In his memoirs, Eden regretted that Western readers had been slower to read it than Mein Kampf, with less excuse because it is shorter and not so turgid. Now, Eden's comparison has no justification, either in content or in the suggestion that appeasement might have been prevented if more attention had been paid to Nasser's book at the time. Only later did Eden begin to describe Nasser as another Hitler. From 1952 to 1954, Eden and his colleagues were prepared to back Nasser as the best bet. Eden's principal miscalculation was on Nasser's reaction to the creation of the Baghdad Pact, which represented the culmination of British political and strategic thought that had originated at the end of the Second World War. Eden guided British policy on that point, but it would be unfair to hold him individually responsible for it. Neither he nor his advisors attached much significance to Nasser's angry reaction. Eden regarded Nasser as an erratic and opportunist leader possessing a strong and dangerous personality. Eden did not perceive the internal logic of Nasser's action that flowed from his position as a national leader in the era of decolonization, or the extent to which suspicions of the British continued to motivate him. When Nasser later accepted arms and economic assistance from the Soviet Union, he acted consistently. He aimed to break the military and economic grip of the Western powers in the Middle East. In the early stages, the pattern was less clear, perhaps even to Nasser himself. The parting of the ways between Eden and Nasser was the creation of the Northern Tier, but Eden at the time remained optimistic about persuading Nasser to join the military alliance. Eden met Nasser for the first and last time in Cairo in February 1955, which was the same month of what became known as the Baghdad Pact. This was a memorable encounter. Nasser came to the British embassy, which he had not visited before. Eden greeted him in Arabic. Nasser commented that he was interested to see the place from which Egypt had been ruled. Egypt demurred, advised perhaps, not ruled, he said. The chief of the Imperial General Staff, Sir John Harding, presented the military case for the Baghdad Pact, which Nasser seemed to accept as theoretically sound. He was being polite. Nasser also seemed to accept, in principle, the prospect of a peaceful settlement with Israel. Nasser was moderate and not unfriendly. Eden departed from Cairo with the sense that useful business had been transacted. The underlying wave of hostility had yet to rise. In early 1955, Eden and Nasser were still on reasonably good terms, as represented in the famous photograph taken on the occasion with Nasser clasping Eden's hand. Upon Churchill's retirement, Eden became prime minister on the 6th of May, 1955, in a general mood of goodwill. He did not make major changes in Churchill's cabinet. It remains puzzling that Eden appointed Harold Macmillan as foreign secretary, though perhaps it was intended as a stopgap until after the election. That at least is what happened. Eden first appointed Selwyn Lloyd as Minister of Defense, and at the end of the year moved Lloyd to the Foreign Office to replace Macmillan, who was then shunted to the Treasury. R.A. Butler, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer until December, then became Lord Privy Seal and Leader of the House of Commons. Apart from Lloyd, who had relatively minor influence, Eden had no close friends or allies among the key figures in the cabinet, except for Lord Salisbury, whose influence transcended his minor offices. Lloyd, Selwyn Lloyd, emerges from the 1955-57 period as Eden's faithful and competent lieutenant. It is useful to remember that during the war, Lloyd had risen to prominence as a highly efficient brigadier with an intense loyalty to difficult commanders, and that despite outright public lying about Suez, he eventually became Speaker of the House of Commons. As Minister of State in the Foreign Office, 1951-1954, Lloyd had served as Eden's deputy in handling much of the day-by-day business of the Sudan and Egypt, but he was always subservient to Eden, not his rival. Eden remained in control. The comparison with Neville Chamberlain in 1937 is irresistible. Eden wished to be his own foreign secretary. The election in May 1955 strengthened the conservative majority. Eden demonstrated mental and physical stamina during the campaign. In 1952, he had married Churchill's niece, Clarissa, who was many years younger. She was, on the whole, a political asset, young, vivacious, and she was devoted to him. She was certainly a source of strength, but she did, according to those close to Eden, contribute to his sense of paranoia. She thought the BBC conspired against him, and she abetted his, I suppose what you could call his emotional anti-Americanism. Eden's health in 1955 seemed to have been restored after a bungled operation in 1953 when the surgeon's hand had slipped and had severed his bile duct. Eden led an active life, though only in his own words, with the aid of drugs and stimulants. His aides noted that his temper had not improved. In the summer of 1955, his minutes became tetchy, especially on Egypt. He responded furiously to the Czech arms deal announced in September, which changed the landscape of the Middle East by indirect Soviet military assistance to Egypt. Previously, the supply of arms had been limited to those provided by Britain, France, and the United States, and Nasser's act of defiance seemed to signify an impending change in the balance of power and the opening of the Middle East to Soviet influence. Eden's reaction was violent but ambivalent. He made a desperate throw of the dice to keep Nasser in the Western camp by a concerted effort with the Americans to subsidize the building of the high dam at Aswan, a project crucial to Egypt's economic development through the electrification and the irrigation of the Nile Valley. On the other hand, the plans to get rid of Nasser originated also at this time. Eden's predominant mood was one of danger and exasperation. The American ambassador in London, Winthrop Aldrich, recounted how Eden asked me to come to see him on a matter of greatest urgency and importance. Eden said that if the Russians managed to provide economic as well as military assistance to Egypt, then this would give the Soviets a dangerous foothold in an area vital to the interests of Great Britain. Aldrich believed that Eden, on this occasion, as on others, was overwrought. Eden was obviously greatly agitated. I think that his physical condition led to his being even more likely than he had been in the past to exaggerate the urgency of any problem with which he is faced. Now, Eden was not alone in believing that drastic action was necessary. Harold Katcha, who had previously served as one of Eden's private secretaries, was now deputy undersecretary at the Foreign Office. Eden trusted Katcha. Their ideas moved in the same direction. Katcha noted in September 1955 that we may have to get rid of Nasser. Eden agreed with this line of thought, but the problem was that no alternative to Nasser seemed feasible. Eden directly instructed the ambassador in Cairo, Sir Humphrey Trevelyan, to report on Nasser's strength and whether he might be toppled from within. Trevelyan's response was unequivocal. There are, at present, no reliable signs of the regime losing its grip or of its opponents gaining ground. Throughout the Suez crisis, Trevelyan never wavered from the view that intervention, covert or overt, would lead to disastrous consequences. Eden tended to minimize and to disregard Trevelyan's advice. According to one of his advisors, Eden was much exercised about the Middle East and is of two minds, oscillating between fear of driving Nasser irrevocably into the Soviet camp and desire to wring the necks of Egypt and Syria. In the hope that Eden might still be appeased, Eden pressed Eisenhower to provide economic assistance for the Haidam. "I hate to trouble you with this," he wrote to Eisenhower, "but I am convinced that on our joint success in excluding the Russians from this contract may depend the future of Africa." Eden earnestly importuned Dulles as well. Eisenhower and Dulles were less alarmist than Eden, but they agreed that Nasser was resorting to blackmail in Eisenhower's phrase, and the offer to finance the dam was made to Nasser in December 1955. The transaction demonstrated the British financial dependency on the United States. Britain could put up only 5.5 million of the total amount of 100 million. Eden seems not to have questioned the assumption that the United States would underwrite British policy towards Egypt, as the case of the Haidam seemed to prove. Yet at the same time, he did not question the other assumption that Britain could still act independently from the United States. Eden feared that Nasser would make a political as well as an economic commitment to the Soviet Union. The dilemma in late 1955 was whether or not to take a harder line. Eden hesitated when the Turks urged him to press for Jordan's membership in the Baghdad Pact. Pro-Egyptian sentiment in Jordan was substantial. Eden wrote to Macmillan, "I am somewhat apprehensive that the effect on Egypt of Jordan joining at this time might be unfortunate." Nevertheless, Eden dispatched Field Marshal Sir Gerald Templer, the chief of the Imperial General Staff, to Jordan to persuade the young King Hussein. Templer was an unfortunate choice. He was a formidable, indeed ferocious soldier, devoted to the imperial cause, but one hardly to persuade others of its merits. Hussein found him offensive, as he had previously. And the Templer case ended in fiasco amidst pro-Nasser demonstrations, which set Eden on edge. He was further disconcerted by information from Secret Service agents who had managed to establish contact with one of Nasser's entourage. The gist was that Nasser was much more in cahoots with the Russians than he had been previously. The effect on Eden was electrifying. The end of the year 1955 was the critical period in the gestation of the Suez Crisis. Eden now began to swing irretrievably towards a more belligerent position. The breaking point came in March 1956 with King Hussein's sacking of General John Glubb, the commander of the Arab Legion. Glubb's dismissal seemed close to, at the time, to a British national humiliation because it was commonly, but erroneously assumed, that Nasser was behind it. Hussein, however, had his own reasons, and the antipathy between Glubb and Hussein symbolized the growing antagonism building up between the forces of the British military presence in the Middle East and those of Arab nationalism. Hussein was his own man, not Nasser's. Some British officials saw this at the time. Eden, on the other hand, managed to convince himself that Nasser now systematically plotted to overthrow the British in Jordan and throughout the Middle East. In the House of Commons, Julian Amory asked ominously for an assurance that we are not going to accept these reverses lying down and that something will be done to restore the general position in the Middle East. In response to this and to other challenges, Eden made perhaps the worst parliamentary speech of his career. Trying to curb his anger against Hussein, he felt frustrated not being able to vent his feelings towards Nasser. He lost the thread of his argument along with his temper. One of his former private secretaries, Evelyn Shuckburgh, wrote, "Eden seems to be completely disintegrated, petulant, irrelevant, provocative, at the same time as being weak." Clarissa Eden wrote in her diary, with words that confirm her husband's state of mind, as well as the debacle of the speech, "The events in Jordan have shattered Antony. He is fighting very bad fatigue, which is sapping his powers of thought. Tonight's winding up of the debate was a shambles." Now, at the time of Glubb's dismissal, Selwyn Lloyd happened to be in Cairo. His purpose had been to discuss with Nasser the terms of the Aswan loan, and at a dinner party in early March, at the same time that Glubb was being ousted, Lloyd, together with Katya and Trevelyan, listened to Nasser's reminiscences about the revolution of 1952. Nasser talked of kings and of conspiracies, of the British, and of further conspiracies. Nasser's account left a profound effect on Lloyd. From then on, Lloyd believed that the working of Nasser's mind revealed itself in speeches just as Hitler's mind had in Mein Kampf. Lloyd learned of Gleb's fate later that night, and the next morning, in an encounter that has become famous in the literature on Suez, Nasser congratulated Lloyd on improving Britain's relations with Egypt by removing Gleb. Lloyd not only thought that this was an outrageous remark, but believed that Nasser had known of the plans the night before and had played an elaborate game of deception. Quite independently, Lloyd reinforced his own ideas of Nasser as a treacherous conspirator, just as Eden's mind was moving in the same direction. This was a critical link. When Eden stated on March 8th that Nasser has to be got rid of, it's either him or us, they were words that represented Lloyd's sentiments as well. Now, Eden relied intimately on Sir Ivan Kirkpatrick, the permanent undersecretary at the Foreign Office, as well as Lloyd. Kirkpatrick's command of the Foreign Office was vigorous, efficient, and often aggressive. He mildly despised Lloyd, whom he did not think up to the job, and often bypassed him to consult directly with Eden. Of all of the principal figures in the Suez crisis, Kirkpatrick demonstrated an actual zest for the opportunity to combat a dictator who, in his view, bore a direct resemblance to Hitler. The comparison came easily because Kirkpatrick had spent 5 years at the embassy in Berlin, 1933 to 1938. He knew little about the Middle East, and since his career had been restricted mainly to Europe, little about the United States. As one of Eden's trusted advisors, Kirkpatrick possessed fateful limitations as well as undoubted capacity. He and Eden spoke the same language. Nasser, as a dictator on the make, had to be stopped at any cost. Both Eden and Kirkpatrick had reached the conclusion by March 1956 that Eden had to be destroyed, if not by financial pressure, then by covert action. As permanent undersecretary, Kirkpatrick was Eden's direct link with the effort to unseat Nasser and other anti-British governments, even though, as permanent head of the Foreign Office, he was committed to the Prime Minister's official policy, which could now be described as one of isolation of Nasser rather than one of direct confrontation. The contradiction of the two courses of action did not seem to bother Eden, but there are still many parts of the covert story that remain obscure. MI6 planned covert operations against Nasser, and Eden apparently received only sporadic briefings. There is nothing surprising about this. The CIA operated independently from the State Department, but Eisenhower kept himself more systematically informed and had the intelligence services under tighter control. The close contacts between CIA and MI6 at the time of the Suez Crisis did not exist to the same degree with the French intelligence. Though Julian Amery, as a former member of MI6, had links with both the French and with certain Egyptians who were alienated from the Nasser regime. By March 1956, Amery had emerged behind the scenes as the champion of the idea that there should be a Franco-British alliance in North Africa and the Middle East. He believed that Eden had handled deplorably the business of Gleb's sacking and had placed Britain in an intolerable and humiliating position. Amery was well aware that the French held Nasser responsible for much of the trouble in Algeria. Nasser was certainly, in Amery's view, the cause of the disintegrating British position in the Middle East. The anti-Nasser combination that Amery proposed some 4 or 5 months before the eruption of the nationalization crisis is significant. It foreshadowed the actual alliance of October, though it fell short of espousing a military alliance with Israel. The general formula, Amery wrote in his diary, and I believe I'm the first one to quote from this unpublished source, is that we should give moral support to the French in North Africa, and that they should give us moral support over the Baghdad Pact, that both of us should strengthen Israel and take every opportunity of being in touch with the dissident Egyptians. In discussing these matters with George Young, the key figure in MI6, Amory formed the opinion that MI6 is well ahead of the Foreign Office and would like to attempt action, but rather doubtful whether the situation is yet ripe. Part of the problem, in Amory's judgment, was that the Foreign Office will wait on the Americans. From Amory's point of view, there was an even more vexatious problem which related to Eden himself. Julian Amory, Noel Annan refers to as the foremost spokesman for the British Empire in his generation, Julian Amory believed that Eden to be so indecisive, that he was incapable of handling the situation. Amory's diary indeed substantiates the sentiment expressed in the famous Daily Telegraph comment early in the year that had wounded Eden, that to emphasize the point, the Prime Minister will clench one fist and smack the open palm of the other hand, but a smack is seldom heard. The rebuff to Nasser that was heard throughout the world was Dulles's cancellation of the offer to assist in the building of the high dam at Aswan. Dulles had been influenced by the mounting protests against the loan by the Israeli lobby, the cotton lobby of the American South, and the China lobby. In May 1956, Nasser had recognized communist China, an action that had antagonized both the Congress and the American public. According to the British ambassador in Washington, there was substantial congressional skepticism whether the Egyptian economy could bear the cost of the Czech arms deal with the staggering new debt service that would be incurred by the Aswan project. The dam in Egypt became a natural target for such sentiment, especially since Nasser had aligned himself with America's enemies in the Cold War. Dulles's withdrawal of the offer of the loan, 19 July 1956, came as no surprise to Eden. He was merely startled that Dulles had acted so quickly and so decisively. On the eve of Nasser's nationalization of the Suez Canal Company in July 1956, American and British policies toward Nasser were still in alignment. The differences that emerged had more to do with how to get rid of Nasser than with the goal itself. By the time of the actual beginning of the Suez Crisis, Nasser's nationalization of the Canal Company on 29 July, Eden had already committed himself to Nasser's destruction. Eden's thought and action continued, however, to be characterized by hesitancy. In the middle part of the Suez Crisis, in August and September 1956, Eden went through a period of self-doubt when he thought that the operation would probably have to be called off in favor of a settlement under the auspices of the United Nations. When British and French troops attacked in early September, it came as a surprise to those closely following the sequence of events, and it came as a further surprise when the military operation ended so abruptly. I close this lecture by anticipating a quotation I shall give later in full from Julian Amory's diary, because it perceptively illuminates the theme I have tried to develop in this lecture of Eden drawing inspiration from Stanley Baldwin and others of an earlier era. I can't help feeling, Amory wrote, that Eden going to war against Nasser was Baldwin playing as Bismarck. It was out of character. Eden's basic approach to the Middle East has been one of appeasement. When suddenly he turned round and decided to smash Nasser, he had no more idea how to play the hand than Chamberlain had when he turned against Hitler in 1939.
I feel like somebody who writes to move a vote of thanks to the writer of one of those thrilling stories which filled my reading when I was at school before the war in Hotspur and Beano and journals of that kind. Every item ended on a cliff face, and one wondered how on earth the hero could extract himself unless it was on the sort of with one mighty jump he was free school of activity. Unfortunately, we know this story. With one mighty jump, Eden was not free. With one mighty jump, we had Harold Macmillan as Prime Minister. We look forward to hearing our next lecture, and I move a temporary vote of thanks in delay as a postponement to the final one, which I shall be moving at the end of the third lecture. Thank you very much indeed.